When you were in junior high school and high school, your English teachers no doubt told you to write in the third person. You resisted because you had a lot to tell the world, but you obliged. After all, he or she was your English teacher. And so you wrote, "It is thought that," or "according to experts," or "trends and statistics show," and in this way, you learned to write. Well, there's a growing number of nonfiction writers who may have sat in the same schoolroom, but somehow have disengaged from the third person. In a form called the personal essay, they're inviting readers into their points of view, and readers in this country are happily obliging. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. My guest today, among other skills and contributions, is making both place and mark as an American essayist. Scott Russell Sanders' most recent offering is Staying Put, Making a Home in a Restless World. Welcome, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
I'm very glad to be here, Susan.
Good. I want to ask you about age and reflection as we move along. But first, do you think the third person is the realm of objectivity? Was the English teacher right about that?
Well, the English teacher was trying to help me grasp how one uses authority, how one draws on what has already been learned in the world. And I learned that quite well in school. That is, I learned to defer to the experts, to the scholars, to the people who have accumulated knowledge. What I did not learn well enough in school, and I mean all the way through graduate school, is to lay claim to my own knowledge, to honor what it is that I specifically have come to understand in my lifetime. So the third person is a voice that defers to scholars. As you suggested in your lead-in, it's the voice that says that never says I think or I feel or I believe or I conclude. It always defers to some other authority. The first person is a voice that says, for better or for worse, This is what I feel, this is what I think, and accepts the fact that one's knowledge is limited.
Is that first thing a good thing to learn, this notion of deferring to others, seeking out other people's thoughts, listening to them and kind of moving them through yourself to the printed page?
It's a useful thing. Clearly, the human beings have been accumulating knowledge for a long time, and everyone should feel a sense of indebtedness to what other people have learned and a sense of respect for what scholars and experts have learned. But so often when we write about our own experience, we are the authority. We are the only one who can make sense of it. Nobody else has ever lived our life. No one else has ever thought about our life. So if we're not willing to take responsibility for making sense of it, sense will not be made of it. Yes, it's important that we learn that deference to authority, but if we learn it too deeply, we are intimidated from thinking about our own lives or thinking about the world through our own minds.
It's only me. Well, it's just what I think. It's not.
Yes, we don't take ourselves seriously enough. There's at the other extreme, clearly, there is the danger of egotism or of arrogance or of the attitude that I don't have anything to learn from anybody. But the personal essayist lives midway between those two extremes. On the one extreme is total deference to authority, and on the other extreme is disregard for authority. The personal essayist, I think, operates in the middle between those extremes.
Do we need to practice to find the middle?
We are not trained in our schools to feel that our own lives are a puzzle that only we can solve. We're trained that the world is a puzzle, which indeed it is, and we're trained that history and science are puzzles, which indeed they are. But we're not trained to think of ourselves, the pattern of our own lives, as something worthy of our attention, worthy of our understanding. So, yes, it is a challenge to learn that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling from your words that you think that's a liability, that we're not learning in the course of growing to examine our own lives and reflect upon them.
I think it is a liability, because if we don't understand how we've come to where we are, We have very little control over where we're going. We don't understand why we're troubled by what troubles us, why we're frightened by what frightens us, why we love what we love. I think we need to examine our lives in order to live our present more fully and more richly.
This is Scott Russell Sanders. He's our guest today on Conversations. And in the course of the next hour, we'll be talking about writing, but writing with a point of view. In this case, the point of view of Scott Russell Sanders. Now, here's an odd question. Everybody has pain. Everybody experiences loss. Everyone has trouble in their lives. And everyone has a belief, and I think sort of phrase. Why write about it? Why do you write? And I don't mean just me sitting down and writing to a letter to a friend, but why publish what you think, what you feel, what you've experienced?
Of course, a lot of what I've written is not about my own personal experience. It's about things I've observed. It's about other people's lives. And in that case, I'm doing it because I think there's something important and interesting and worthy of attention in those lives. When I write about my own life, including the painful passages in my own life, I don't do so because I think the world should pay attention to me. I do so because I know that other people have had pain in their lives or have had bewilderment in their lives. Not the same pain, not the same bewilderment that I have experienced, but they have had their own passages of trouble. And that by my thinking through and trying to discover a pattern in my trouble, the experience of reading that for them may help them to make better sense of their lives. And judging by what people tell me through letters, through phone conversations, and when I go around and visit and meet people who've read my books, judging from what they say, many people do in fact find that to be the case, that as they read about how I have wrestled with difficult passages in my own life, they find themselves wrestling with passages in their life. And that's what I want.
I see. It is, and is that why we want to read, do you think, the personal essays of a Scott Russell Sanders or a Terry Tempest Williams?
There are a number of reasons, and I'm speaking of myself now as a reader. That is why I read people like Terry Tempest Williams or Wendell Berry or Annie Dillard or Barry Lopez. I'm interested in the effort of other people to live integrated lives, to make sense of the various pieces and fragments of their lives, to resist the disintegrating effects of our culture. Because our culture does tear us apart. It scatters our attention. It fragments our knowledge. And therefore, when an essayist tries to articulate a whole integrated self, that is a spectacle I want to witness. And I would hope that readers would find some of that effort in my own books. And again, it's not because who Terry Tempest Williams is or Barry Lopez or Scott Sanders. It's not because we're important. It's because the effort of living an integrated life is important and that we're all called to do that.
And so you think there is some modeling going on and some attending to the modeling that's going on in the writing of personal essays at this time in this place?
I see it happening in the United States. There's a great upswing in the interest in the personal essay, greater than ever before in American history. That is, there are more writers of real distinction working in the form, and there seems to be a more eager readership for it right now than ever before. And there are a number of reasons for that, I'm sure, only a few of which I can guess at. One is that we live in a time of bankrupted language, of devalued language. Language is used in our culture to sell things, to camouflage things, whereas in the personal essay there's an insistence on language as a way of conveying things, of communicating things, of speaking openly and honestly. And there's a real hunger for that kind of openness and honesty. That's one appeal. Another is what I was saying before. We feel so torn apart, tugged in so many different directions, that the effort to be a whole person is something that we need deliberately to make. It doesn't come naturally or easily to us. And the personal essay is one place where we see that happening.
These are longings for communication that means something and for integration that is lacking?
Yes, and for the effort to live collectively and responsibly in an era of experts. Many people, most people, feel intimidated by the knowledge that there are specialists out there who know far more about any given subject than any of us is ever going to know. And it's very easy to be intimidated by specialists. That's the realm of the third person. And yet we still have to live our lives as individuals. We have to make choices. We have to make commitments in marriage or in friendship. And we have to bear responsibilities. So the personal essay is a realm in which people act out the effort to live responsibly and collectively.
I talked to someone recently who said he thought personal essayists, especially someone like Terry Tempest Williams, who is a scientist as well, an ornithologist and a biologist, that people like Terry Tempest Williams were translating from the experts to the people. Do you feel that in your way, sometimes you're translating?
Certainly. I have bodies of knowledge, pockets of knowledge that are the results of my obsessions. I mean, I studied physics for years and years and years and love it, and I love science in general. And I frequently draw on science in my writings, especially physics and astronomy. I frequently draw on it as a source of metaphors, as a source of language, or for analogies. And I don't do that because I'm trying to teach the lay reader how to think about the origin and history of the universe. There are people far better equipped to do it than I am. I do it because when I think about the world, science is an integral part of how I imagine the world. And to draw into the common language metaphors from the areas of specialization, such as astronomy, to draw those into the common language seems to me an important function of writing. The romantic poets, people like Wordsworth and Coleridge and Shelley, said explicitly that one of their goals was to humanize science, that is, to draw into the general human conversation the discoveries of science. I happen to feel that science is one of the great human enterprises, probably the single greatest human enterprise, the collective discoveries of science, accumulated over generations in civilization after civilization. And yet we haven't yet internalized very much of these discoveries into our daily lives and our daily language. And in my own small way, I'm trying to do that. There are lots of other people, of course, doing it as well.
The common people seem to use science as magic.
Science as magic, or science as the realm of experts.
Yeah.
But all it is a very elaborate, intricate effort to draw maps of our shared world.
I wonder if you'd read for us.
I'd be glad to.
And we've got, just so people who are listening know, we've got books scattered all over the table. So I'll let you look and think about what you might want to read, given what we're talking about.
Here's the opening of an essay from a book called The Paradise of Bombs. It's just a little over a page. And I hope that it conveys something of my interest in the natural world and perhaps a little bit about what science might have to do with it.
Scott, tell me where you are.
It's on page 33 of The Paradise of Bombs. It's okay. The opening of an essay called Listening to Owls.
Thank you.
On the morning after the winter solstice, 2 hours before sunrise, moon full, I stood on frozen feet beside a pine grove in southern Indiana and listened for owls. The pine boughs were dark featherings on darkness. Every winter weed and bush in the meadow cast a pale moon shadow. Burst milkweed pods hung upon last year's stems like giant commas. Breath haloed about my face in the 5-degree air. In such stillness, an owl could hear the footpads of mice, the rustling of rabbits, but I, with my clumsy ears, could hear nothing. The friend who had brought me to this owl country, Don Whitehead, a husky man with sun creases around his eyes, who indulges his passion for the outdoors by teaching ecology, Don cupped gloved hands to his mouth and uttered a long cry, rather like the noise a strangled rooster might make. This was the barred owl's call, which bird books will tell you sounds like a guttural rendering of, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" But don't let the cozy sentences fool you. The cry of the barred owl, even the counterfeit cry my friend Don was making, resembles no human speech. It is night speech. So there we stood on the longest night of the year, two grown men hooting into the darkness and listening. Presently, a cow answered, lowing mournfully. Next, a dog yapped, then two more, then a fourth, all at a great distance from us and seemingly from all four points of the compass. We were surrounded by domesticity. When a rooster chimed in, I began to despair of owls. Gingerly, afraid my iced toes might shatter, I rocked from foot to foot. Don motioned for me to keep still. Dogs, cow, and rooster obligingly hushed. A moonlit smile stole across his face. He pointed away from the pine woods and across the meadow toward a cedar-topped ridge. I faced where he pointed, shut my eyes, and listened. Listened so hard my shivering body grew calm. What I heard sounded at first like a distant creek splashing over rocks. I disappeared into my listening. The water sound grew sharper, divided into syllables, spoke to me at last in the 60-million-year-old voice of an owl.
From the Paradise of Balms, the essay Listening to Owls, just the beginning. This is so full of attention and awe that it makes me want to stand very still and listen. Is this something that you, does this relate in any way for
it,
you?
It does. There's a well-known couplet from the poet William Blake. Blake wrote, he said, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, we would see the world as it is, infinite." And I do feel that we fall into routines and patterns and become jaded. I was just talking with someone today at the university, a student, about how someone coming like myself from elsewhere to Alaska, how absolutely everything is vivid. The paper birch trees that people who live in Fairbanks have seen billions of and perhaps don't even notice anymore. Every one of them is just amazing to me. It's so exquisitely beautiful. Well, that refreshing of our senses, that is seeing the world anew, perceiving it afresh, is one of the reasons we write. That is, the effort of writing renews the world for us. I can tell you a little anecdote. I've written about this elsewhere that illustrates this. When my daughter, who's now 21 years old, was a two-year-old, I was carrying her to the car one day in a blanket. She was taking a nap, and I had her nestled up against my chest, and it was a March day, very brisk out, and I was carrying her from the house to the car, and halfway to the car, all of a sudden she stiffened and bristled, and I stopped, and I thought, did I pinch her or something? And she went back to sleep, and I took another couple of steps, and all of a sudden she stiffened and bristled again. And finally it dawned on me what she was doing was responding to the wind. It was just the wind coming across her face, and it was waking her up, and she would stare into the wind, which I hadn't even felt. But she would stare into the wind as though it were a whole flock of angels. It was so miraculous to her. And the very experience of sensing the wind through this child renewed it for me. The effort of writing about the world, whether it's listening to owls or any other part of the world, the effort of writing about the world is in part the attempt to renew it, to refresh it, for me and I hope for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Are you becoming more acute in your senses as you write about owls or about anything else? Or is this something that Scott has carried through his life?
It's probably both. I think a lot of people who become writers, or perhaps painters, or perhaps other sorts of artists, are moved to do so because the world enters their senses in a fierce way. Mary Oliver, the poet, has this wonderful line where she says, "The world enters us through the five rivers." Of course, she means our senses, our sight and smell and so forth. In part, I think people who become artists and maybe especially writers are people whose rivers, the five rivers, flow very strongly and bring in fierce sensations from the world. But also, I'm convinced that the effort of writing, of attending to things, of making notes about things, of looking at things, the effort of writing has made me more attentive. I notice more things than I would notice if I were not writing about the world.
You're listening to Scott Russell Sanders with us today on Conversations. We've mentioned a number of books, and there are a number of books, 15 and more. Scott has written short stories, novella, novels, children's stories, what we think of as journalistic or documentary essays, and personal essays. It's a broad range of attentiveness to form, I think. Among his personal essays, which are our subject today, The Paradise of Bombs is now in its third printing, most recently in 1993 by Beacon Press. The other two books of essays we'll bring into consideration today are also published by Beacon. In paper in 1992, The Secrets of the Universe. Among other things, this book takes a look at Scott's thoughts about writing, if that interests. And most recently in 1993 by Beacon, Staying Put, Making a Home in a Restless World. Scott read in this half hour from The Paradise of Bombs. Scott is a professor at Indiana University. He's been at that university since 1971, is now a full professor in the Department of English, where he has, over the time, periodically directed undergraduate studies and twice been the director of creative writing. Scott Russell Sanders with us today on Conversations. Your writing, I've noticed as I've read and browsed, is both... Boy, I want to ask you, so I'm not sure I want to put too many thoughts in your mind, but I have noticed that it does several things. It's conversational, it's personal, it's anecdotal. It does bring experts from the field in to talk about one thing or the other. It also talks about, in very serious, not conversational, not, and in sometimes lyrical ways, about subjects very important to you, to our culture. Now, I've noticed this kind of, I've gotten this range of impressions from your writing, and with that liability, want to ask you, how do you look at your writing when it comes together?
I frequently in my writing will start from an anecdote, from a scene, from a particular thing happening, and then move outward from that to larger considerations. That's not a strategy. It's not something I sit down and calculate. I will write an essay like this. That seems to be the way my mind works. I will start with a concrete situation, an incident or an event, and my mind will begin reflecting on it and elaborating on it and perhaps draw larger and larger conclusions from it as I continue to reflect. I've written, as you suggest, in a whole bunch of different genres. And one way to make this concrete is if you were to go in a bookstore that carried all of my books, by the way, if you find such a bookstore, give me the address and I'd like to go kiss the proprietor. But if you were to go to a bookstore that had all of my books, they would be in about 10 different locations. There'd be some in children's books, some in nature writing, some in autobiography, some in historical fiction, some in the contemporary novel, and so forth. Well, that's a frustration to me as a writer because I know I'm the same person who wrote them all, and I know that I have thought about a relatively small number of questions in all of those books, no matter what form they take. And it frustrates me that writers who know one part of my work didn't even realize I had this other part of my work. Well, what are some of those questions? They're large questions. One of them is, how has the North American continent shaped our culture? I mean, that's a big question, right? How has the encounter with the wilderness and with native peoples and with animals and with space, huge space, how has that affected our culture for better or for worse? That's a question that has preoccupied me for years. Another question is, why are we so violent? Why do we go to war? Why do we murder one another? Why do we rape one another? Why do we throw stones and throw adjectives at one another? Where does that violence come from? Is it in the species? Is it in the gender? Where does it come from? I'm also preoccupied with questions about science and technology, how they fit into our lives, how they affect our prospects. And finally, I guess if I could list others, but the last one I'll mention is the question of where do we belong in the order of nature? We're animals, but we're odd animals. We're animals that think about how we behave. We're not just governed by instinct. We're governed by all sorts of other things. So where do we fit in the natural order? I think that's a question that the whole species had better answer pretty soon, or we're not going to be around to ask the question.
Mm-hmm. These are interests and missions.
Yes.
You want us to think about these
yes.
things.
I don't write about them because I think I have the answers. I don't think anybody has the answer. I certainly don't. I write about them because I think these are the questions. And that what we need is as many people as possible thinking about these questions and bringing to bear their own experience, their own understanding to the answers. And we need as much good wisdom brought to bear on these questions as we can find.
Where's the level of dialogue, do you think, at this point?
For the writer, the activity of writing does not involve dialogue. It's a very solitary action. You do bear in mind a reader or readers, and because of that, there's an implicit dialogue. That is, when I put words on the page, I'm anticipating as well as I can what people like Susan McInnes might want to know or might quarrel with or might disagree with. And therefore, in my writing, I have tried to answer, to anticipate an intelligent reader's response. So there's a kind of implicit dialogue that's actually buried in the writing itself. The larger dialogue is one that is carried on in communities. It's carried on in households. It's carried on in bed. It's carried on all over the place. It's carried on television and on radio. It's a dialogue about what sort of creatures we are, how we should live, what is a good life, what is an honorable life, and that's a question. Those are questions that are as old as our species, and I think they're going to continue as long as we're around.
Let me ask you about your most recent book, Staying Put. Why, for one question, why tell people it's time to settle down, given in light of the issues you just raised for us? Why is one of the answers to our concerns in this culture to set down roots?
Well, I have pursued two lines of inquiry and concern for decades, and it finally dawned on me they were the same concern. One concern was, why are we devouring the planet? That is, why are we actually eating up nature and despoiling the natural world? And how might we change that? What resources do we have that might enable us to live more sustainably on the earth? That's one question. The other question is, how do human beings live in community with one another, alongside one another, with all of our differences and all of our individual idiosyncrasies, and yet still live beside one another in cooperation and harmony? So one question is about living in nature, and the other question is about living in community. Of course, they're the same question. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that. This book that you're referring to, Staying Put, is an effort to speak about the coming together of these two concerns. The only way that we can live responsibly on land is if there are enough people who are paying attention, who are keeping track, who really are committed to places and say, this matters to me. I want to live here. I hope my children choose to live here. I want this place to be cared for. I don't want it to be used up. I don't want it to be poisoned. I don't want it to be washed downstream. I want it to endure. And when you have enough people in enough places who have that kind of commitment to their places, to the land itself, then we have some prospect of living sustainably. At the same time, the only way we have hopes of creating strong and peaceful and supportive human communities is if there is some degree of continuity and solidarity. As long as people are moving in and out obsessively, we cannot develop a sense of community. So those two things are linked.
How do we get there from here?
Well, you don't get there from here just by writing a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't pretend that people are going to read my book and say, well, he's right, that's what we should do. On the other hand, I've had lots of letters from people who said, surprising number of letters from people who said, you know, Mr. Sanders, I've really been debating whether to pull up roots and go over yonder and do something else. And I didn't quite know what to do. And I've read this and thought about it. And it really helps me see that I belong here. I should invest myself and commit myself to this place. So I think there are a lot of people who feel a hunger to belong, to be part of a place and to be committed to it. There are a lot of people who feel that hunger, but it's not an American thing to do. The American thing to do is to pick up roots and strike out for new territory, like Huck Finn at the end of his novel. The American thing to do is to keep moving, to keep traveling on. And there are certainly glories in that. It's produced many, many great cultural figures, like the cowboy. It's produced all sorts of adventures and energy, but it's also produced a lot of devastation, natural devastation and human devastation. So I'm raising a voice against that. Mine's not the only voice. There are lots of other people now who are speaking on behalf of commitment to place. And all I can hope is that enough people will feel that transience and mobility is not the solution. It's part of the problem.
Will you read to us from this book and these thoughts?
I'd be glad to. Here's a section from, I'll read two things. This is just a little paragraph from the opening. The book tells about why I can't go back to my native place. I grew up in Ohio, and the place where I grew up in Ohio is divided in half. One half of it is a military reservation from which I have been cut off by fences and government rules. The other half of the place where I grew up is underwater. A dam was built and the land was flooded. So I can't go back to that place. And this book is not about going back to one's native place. This book is about choosing a place in adulthood. And here's a paragraph about that. There's no need to go looking for home, of course, unless you're lost. I have been lost in ways no map could remedy. I cannot return to my native ground and take up residence there. The farm in Tennessee where I spent my earliest years is buried under asphalt. The military reservation where I lived next is locked away behind fences and soldiers. And the farm in Ohio where I spent the rest of my childhood has been erased entirely. The house and barn bulldozed by the army, the woods and fields flooded by a boondoggle dam. If I am to have a home, it can only be a place I have come to as an adult, a place I have chosen. And I will read another, if I may, just one more paragraph. And this is about something of what's entailed in committing yourself to a place. To become intimate with your home region, to know the territory as well as you can, to understand your life as woven into the local life, does not prevent you from recognizing and honoring the diversity of other places, cultures, ways. On the contrary, how can you value other places if you do not have one of your own? If you are not yourself placed, then you wander the world like a sightseer, a collector of sensations with no gauge for measuring what you see. Local knowledge is the grounding for global knowledge. Those who care about nothing beyond the confines of their parish are in truth parochial, and are at least mildly dangerous to their parish. On the other hand, those who have no parish, those who navigate ceaselessly among postal zones and area codes, those for whom the world is only a smear of highways and bank accounts and stores, are a danger not just to their parish, but to the planet.
Scott Sanders reading from his latest book. It's called Staying Put. Once again, from Beacon Press. It was published in 1993. I'm Susan McGinnis. You're listening to Conversations. Scott Russell Sanders is the guest of the University of Alaska English Department. In his tenure of a week or so here, he has lectured several times, been very busy, on a craft talk, giving a reading. He's worked with particular students in the creative writing program, those who are working in the nonfiction area, and he's lectured classes. The English department brings visiting writers up to Fairbanks to enhance the community of writers as well as the community of readers. Scott Russell Sanders is the latest.
I should say, Susan, that in looking at the list of visiting writers coming just this spring to Fairbanks through the university, I was astonished at the number of people coming. It's a very ambitious program, and I think it speaks very well of the people who direct the program at the university and the university itself to be so concerned to bring writers to this city.
Good to hear that. I want to ask you about... I want to keep us with staying put, if we can, for a moment. I sense an issue of both the land and the spirit of the human being in some parts of your writing. You write at one point about whether this isn't a religious issue or should be a religious issue, but it is an issue of the spirit. And I wondered if you'd address that. Why do you think a relationship between the human being and the land is spiritual?
I suppose I'm an ineradicably, irreformably religious writer. Not religious in the sense of proposing some system, and certainly not advocating some particular religion. But it seems to me that religion is our way of asking the fundamental questions. Where are we? Why are we here? Why is there a universe rather than nothing? It would be a lot easier for there to be nothing, right? But no, there isn't nothing. There's this enormous, complicated universe, and here we are in the middle of it. And why is there life? There are, of course, no answers to these questions, but we wouldn't be human if we didn't ask them. And the realm in which we ask those questions is what we know as religion. So I ask those questions and think about them in my books. And Staying Put is perhaps the most explicit of my books in dealing with spiritual questions. When I try to understand what my foundations are, what am I in my deepest depth, I can't answer that question apart from place. I can't answer it apart from, in my case, marriage, connection to another human being, being a parent, connection to my children, being connected to neighbors. Those are intrinsic to who I am. So when I pose the question, who am I? What am I? Why is there this consciousness? Why does it exist? I begin the answers from where I am, from the actual land, from the community in which I live, from the household in which I live. And when I say that they're spiritual questions, I mean that without reflecting on and grasping something about our foundations, we float over the surface, we drift through our lives rootless. And so the effort to root myself in place and in community is connected to my effort to root myself in a spiritual ground.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember this, and I'll have to paraphrase. You wrote that we've lost track of or failed to learn a language, and it is the language that God speaks, and what we need to know is that God speaks the universe. Is that close enough?
That's close enough.
Tell me what that means to you.
We make maps of the universe. Some of the maps we call religions. Some of them we call physics. We make lots of maps of the universe. We're very tempted to mistake the map for the universe, to think, here's this beautiful structure I have articulated. That's the real thing, whether the structure is a particular religion or whether it's a scientific formula. We're very tempted to think that's the real thing. Of course, it's not the real thing. All it is our best effort to speak about, to point towards the real thing. The real thing is the universe itself. It's an unfathomable mystery. We are never going to know why there's a universe. We're never going to know why we're here. All we can do is ask the question in as many different languages as we can muster. But we should never be fooled into thinking that some particular map, some particular scheme is the ultimate one, the final one. The Buddhists in the Zen tradition have a little parable that helps articulate what I'm talking about. The teachings of a Zen master are referred to as a finger pointing towards the moon. The disciple who looks at the finger and says, ah, this is the real thing. I see this finger and look at this fingernail and look at these lines and the knuckle, is missing the point. The point is not the finger. The point is the moon. And the same way, when we learn a map, whether the map is a religion or a philosophy or a psychology or a science, when we learn the map and we think, ah, this is the thing, rather than the moon, then we're limiting ourselves and we're underestimating the complexity and subtlety and depth of the universe.
Is it, from your perspective, is the language best spoken in attending to your daughter who bristles at the wind or the sound of the owl or the shaking of your knees? Or
I think it is. At least it's what I'm most moved by and most engaged by. I respect the formulas. I respect the tables of statistics. I respect the labels. And there are things to be learned from all of those abstractions. But finally, we live in terms of particular places, particular people, particular things, and those particulars are where we will find the truth, if we find it anywhere. We will not find it in the generalizations and the abstractions. We will find it in the particulars.
Scott Russell Sanders with us today. I'm wanting you to kind of read frequently as we move through this hour so that people get different glimpses of you. I'm thinking now of the inheritance of tools, writing about your dad's death and your response to it, how it affected your life, because you've written on very personal levels as well as on levels that we would think of as these larger issues. The inheritance of tools is an essay that appeared in The Paradise of Bombs. While Scott's looking, let me just mention among his awards and distinctions, Under the Influence is also a story about his father, won a National Magazine Award nomination from Harper's in 1990. The Inheritance of Tools, from which he'll be reading, was a Best American Essays selection in 1987. He also was given the Associated Writing Programs Award for Nonfiction for Paradise of Bombs, the book in which this essay is found, again in 1987. And Wayland was the Best American Essays selection for 1993, among awards and distinctions for this writer, Scott Russell Sanders.
Well, I'll read, Susan, the opening paragraph of The Inheritance of Tools, which I hope conveys something about the struggle to come to terms with the loss of someone dear to you, in this case my father, but most of us, once we reach a certain age, have lost someone dear to us, and I hope it translates to other people's experience. At just about the hour when my father died, soon after dawn one February morning when ice coated the windows like cataracts, I banged my thumb with a hammer, naturally, I swore at the hammer, the reckless thing, And in the moment of swearing, I thought of what my father would say. If you try hitting the nail, it would go in a whole lot faster. Don't you know your thumb's not as hard as that hammer? We both were doing carpentry that day, but far apart. He was building cupboards at my brother's place in Oklahoma. I was at home in Indiana putting up a wall in the basement to make a bedroom for my daughter. By the time my mother called with news of his death, the long-distance wires whittling her voice until it seemed too thin to bear the weight of what she had to say, my thumb was swollen. A week or so later, a white scar in the shape of a crescent moon began to show above the cuticle, and month by month it rose across the pink sky of my thumbnail. It took the better part of a year for the scar to disappear, and every time I noticed it, I thought of my father.
Why did you decide to write about your dad's death?
I didn't want his death to be only loss. Death is always loss, but I didn't want it to be only loss. I wanted there to be something left. I was looking for a legacy, not a legacy of money. I was looking for a legacy, something that endured. Nothing permanent is, and nothing human, obviously, is permanent. Nothing I write is permanent. But it's durable. It's less transient than our flesh. So I wanted to make a monument to him out of words, but I also wanted to recover something for myself. I wanted to discover what it was he had left with me. I knew he had left me a great deal, but I didn't really know what it was. And so the writing of this essay was a search for the legacy, and that's why it ended up being called The Inheritance of Tools. Mm-hmm. And the tools he left me were actual tools, a claw hammer, a crowbar, a saw, but they were also intellectual and emotional tools. They were a certain attitude towards work, for example. He was a great craftsman. He had tremendous pride in his woodworking and in his gardening and in his handling of animals. And to watch him do something was a way of learning what it meant to take pride in good work. He never preached to me about it. He just did it, and I watched him do it, and I learned something from him. He also taught me that a human being is an extraordinarily versatile creature, that we can learn almost anything, and that if you set your mind to it, you can learn practically anything you need to do to provide for your own life. You can find somebody who can show you how to do it, and you can learn how to do it. And that confidence in one's own capacities, one's own ability to learn and to master things, that confidence was another gift from him. So in the writing of the essay, which is about his dying and about losing him, I'm also simultaneously speaking about what he has left behind. Mm-hmm. And that's true of every death. No death is entirely lost. We wouldn't feel it as loss if it didn't leave something. If there wasn't something of the person that stayed with us, we wouldn't even register the loss.
I'm wondering what it's like to write a piece like that, but also not just a piece about your father's death. Is this profession you're in an emotionally and spiritually and intellectually challenging and sometimes exhausting profession? Or do these rivers that flow through you fill you?
It's exhausting. When you finish a piece of writing, and you know this, I know from your own writing, when you finish a piece of writing about something that really matters to you, that's central to you, you're drained. But it's a good kind of exhaustion. It's the sort of exhaustion you feel after making a wonderful meal for friends. And you're tired out, but you've done something, you've made something that other people can share. I think of writing as like food. It is like something you have cooked for other people to eat. And in the eating it, they don't destroy it. It's still there to be re-eaten. But it is a kind of food. It's a nourishment that you give, that you put out for other people to eat. And I eat other people's nourishment all the time, and I've done so since I learned how to read. In the making of such a thing, you can be drained, and sometimes it can take me months to recover from the effort of writing even a particular essay, let alone a whole book. I may be 3 months before I have the energy to start a new piece. And as I get older, I'm now 48, as I get older, I recognize that I will have less and less resilience, so that I have to be careful that I commit myself to the real work, what Gary Snyder called the real work, and not do trivial work, not do busy work. It's got to be important things, because I only have so much energy and I only have so many years. At the same time, I feel renewed by the making of well-made essays. In the same way, if my father made a chest of drawers, he'd be tired from making it, but when it was done and the drawers fit well and everything looked handsome, there was a satisfaction in something well made. And I feel that. I know that some of my essays are well made. And if I weren't able to perceive that, I wouldn't be a decent writer.
Mm-hmm. Are you growing all the time in this process? Is that the return?
I'm understanding more about my life. I'm seeing things that I never saw before. I'm appreciating aspects of other people's lives that I didn't adequately appreciate before. I learn more things about language, and something that I haven't really spoken about, although maybe it's implicit in our whole discussion, is that a great part of the reward for me of writing is that language itself is this wonderful medium. It's this miraculous medium, and the pleasure of navigating in the ocean of language is a good part of the reason I write, because I just love to be in the midst of language.
Mm-hmm. It's like music. It's remarkable. There's really nothing to it, and yes, there's everything to it.
I can remember my sister, bless her heart, is 3 years older than I am, and she taught me how to read when I was three. She would come home from first grade, and she would teach me what she had learned that day. So as she learned to read, she taught me how to read. And I was just being her little student, and I adored her, and so I learned everything she taught me. And I can still remember how on one day there was this page, and it had nothing but black marks on it. And on the next day, that same page had visions on it. That is, I could see those black marks, and things would arise, pictures would come into my mind. And to take nothing but little squiggly black marks on a piece of white paper and then make something happen in a person's mind seemed to me a miracle. And after all these years and having written all these books and read lots of books, it still seems to me a miracle.
Was that the flint and steel, your imagination and your sister's gift?
It was definitely a gift. It was definitely a gift. And I don't know why it has stayed with me in particular, because lots of people have been treated well by their older brothers and sisters, but it seemed to me like a durable gift. And I felt a magical power in language, not a power to govern the world, but a power to share visions with other human beings. Because otherwise, you know, we're very much shut up inside our own skin and our own consciousness, and it's hard to reach across the barriers between us. But language is one of the ways that we can reach across the barrier.
I want to ask you a question that may be impertinent, and you can just shove it aside if it is. I asked you if this writing was a process of growth for you, and you bypassed that word immediately and went to, well, I learn a lot and I this and I that. Is growth something else, or are you just being specific?
When I think about growth, it is learning. That's how I translate that. It is learning to feel more, to see more, to understand more. I don't know that I'm a better person or a worse person as a result of writing. I know I'm a more considered person, not considerate, but considered, that is, someone who thinks about my life more, far more than I would if I didn't write. And not just my own life. It can sound very narcissistic, as though all I'm interested in is me. And you know from reading my books that's not the case, but the conversation might sound that way. I'm interested in being human and what it means to be human and our place in the universe. And I'm reporting on one person's effort to understand that. But my effort is simply one alongside all the other efforts that other human beings are made have made. Growth for me has entailed making a deeper commitment to a place and to a relationship, to a love relationship, to work. And the writing has been part and parcel of that effort.
Mm-hmm. I see. It's a different channel, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. We have moments left. Is there a short fragment you'd like to leave us with?
Well, here's a little piece from an essay also about my father. And it's from a book called Secrets of the Universe. The sporting legends I carry from my father are private rather than public. I am haunted by scenes that no journalist recorded, no camera filmed. Father is playing a solo round of golf, for example, early one morning in April. The fairways glisten with dew. Crows rasp and fluster in the pines that border the course. Father lofts a shot toward a par three hole, and the white ball arcs over the pond, over the sand trap, over the shaggy apron of grass onto the green, where it bounces, settles down, then rolls toward the flag, rolls unerringly, inevitably, until it falls with a scarcely audible click into the hole. The only eyes within sight besides his own are the crows. For once, the ball has obeyed him perfectly, harmonizing wind and gravity and the revolution of the spheres. One shot has gone where all are meant to go, and there is nobody else to watch. He stands on the tee, gazing at the distant hole, knowing what he has done and that he will never do it again. The privacy of this moment appeals to me more than all the clamor and fame of a shot heard round the world.
Mm. A thing well made.
I hope so.
Yes. Scott Russell Sanders, thank you very much. That last fragment came from Secrets of the Universe. Let me tell you again, if you are intrigued, as I hope you are, our guest today, Scott Russell Sanders, has three books of personal essays. Look for The Paradise of Bombs, Secrets of the Universe, and Staying Put, Making a Home in a Restless World. You can find them all from Beacon Press, many in libraries and in bookstores. And then look for Scott's other books. We had no time today to talk about his fiction or some of his documentary essays, all of which I think you might find intriguing. Once again, Scott Sanders brought to this microphone by the English Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm Susan McInnes. I've been your host today. I hope you join me again next week. Scott, thank you very much.
I enjoyed it.
I'm glad.